This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. I'm Jeff O'Neill.
I'm Rebecca Shinsky.
You're still not used to it yet.
You're still not used to doing this yet.
What do I have to do to get... you say your name.
I'm just over here opening tabs, looking at LeVar Burton, getting ready to do my job and forgetting to introduce myself.
Yeah, you do the jobs in order. Your first job is to say your name on the podcast intro.
I am Rebecca Shinsky. We are not going to edit that intro.
No, we're staying in. Because, you know, let that be a lesson to you.
I know. Last week when I had Vanessa on, I just got to run through the, like, I'm Rebecca Shinsky and I'm here with Vanessa. Yeah. I was like, oh, right. I don't have to wait. Catch my cue here.
When I have said my name, you say your... You don't even say... You could just say Rebecca Shinsky and I would give you credit at this point.
Just Rebecca Shinsky. Yeah. Just like I'm announcing myself on a weird Zoom call.
Yeah. That's when you're filling out your voicemail that the AI is going to fill in the rest of it. In any way, today is Thursday, February 22nd, 2024, coming to you from BookRiot.com. Today, we're going to talk about National Book Awards opening up to non-U.S. citizens, the aforementioned LeVar Burton book deals, book ban stuff. We have an occasion to talk about Marilyn Robinson. I snuck in, I don't know if you saw, a story about KKR talking more about its plans to sell or not sell SNS. Mm-hmm. I think the publishing industry still doesn't understand private equity, and I'm not saying that I am. I'm not saying that, you know, I wrote Barbarians at the Gate or something like this. but that people thought this story was over and is not. That SNS was going to be, you know, Warren Buffett, KKR is not. They're not going to hold on to it like See's Candies for 60 years while they live in their split level in Omaha. So I thought it was worth revisiting now that the smoke has cleared a little bit to think about the future of SNS. I also want to talk about book sales for a minute for the year to date.
Okay.
I don't have a link. I wrote down a couple of notes and I'm not even sure where I saw it. So maybe, I guess it was Publishers Weekly. So that's what the show is going to be doing today. I don't know that we have I don't have a lot of follow-up. We did our first or second, I guess it was our second mailbag for the Patreon, but this time we also had some recommendation requests. Thank you so much for those who got in there on the comments to a couple of those on the Patreon and gave their own reflections and everything else.
Super
like
fun.
Good to see. If you haven't checked out the Patreon, go do that. I guess relatedly, coming up, we're going to record later today the next Patreon episode, which is the next edition of Deals, Deals, Deals. I was
one of my favorites
this morning combing through. I had tabbed some things, bookmarked some tweets, like it's 2017 out here.
Wow, brave.
For those of you who haven't listened to Deals, 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 there'll be a preview in the feed for those of you to get in a moose-boosh about what that's going to be like. I basically collect notable deal information and then say them at Rebecca, and then we react, I guess. This is not most anticipated. This is not the best of. This is not Power Ranking, Heat Watch, It Book, any of the synthetic structures that we and the internet have created to put books in a lattice work to talk about things that aren't yet. This is the parameters for this are or better.
Right. Someone got a book deal and we have a few things to say about
it. There's something to say about it. So it's always fun. It's a little more loose than when we do a typical ranking or list or something like that. Yeah. So
It is so fun. And we've been doing them long enough now that like some of the books that you first told me about during a Deals episode have come out and we've read them and we've talked about them together. And that's fun to kind of run that whole cycle.
I would say our matriculation rate on actually reading things that I mentioned here is what, 10-12%? Like this is not even like we're going to read them. Sometimes it's notable for some reason or weird or... Oh, yeah, or
I'd
you
be
forgot
surprised
about.
If it's 10%. Yeah.
So, anyway, lots of fun. Is this the most insidery thing we do regularly? Talk about books that aren't coming out for 2 years that may or may not ever come out that we may forget exist?
Maybe from using those parameters, it is, because occasionally folks will be like, can you drop links to those books? And I'm like, there aren't any.
There aren't links.
Yeah. Most of them don't have landing pages on their publishers' websites yet. Typically, they don't even have publication dates at the time the deal is being announced. It's just this publisher has agreed to buy this book and make it into a thing.
Yeah.
So we will get these somewhere between 18 months and 3 years from now, typically.
Yeah.
From that side, it's pretty insidery. But then there's the stuff we do where we're like what we're going to do later this year, where we're going to read something that's been out for 30 or 40 years, like The Remains of the Day, and watch the movie and talk about it. And that's more of like a book nerd thing, not so much inside baseball. But that's the flavor of the Patreon is like a couple notches deeper into the book cave than this feed.
So always fun to see. Stick around for that. You can check out First Edition, Better Living for Books, the Book Grab Podcast newsletter. All the links are in the show notes there. And we're going to do a sponsor break and actually talk about the things we were just saying we're going to talk about right now.
Today's episode is brought to you by Scribner. Weird Black Girls by Elwyn Cotman is a collection of 7 stories in which characters pursue their obsessions on paths to glory and destruction, while all around them their worlds twist and warp, oscillating between reality and impossibility. On display throughout is Cotman's ability to reveal truths about the human experience, about things like friendship, love, betrayal, bitterness, all through whimsy, horror, and fantasy. Elegiac in tone, imaginative, and humorous in their execution, the character-driven stories in Weird Black Girls challenge, incite, and entertain. The author's last book was named one of NPR's Best Books of the Year and was a finalist for the Philip K. Dick Award, with reviews appearing in the New York Times, Wired, BuzzFeed, and Locus, among other publications. Definitely make sure to check out Weird Black Girls by Elwyn Cotman. And thanks again to Scribner for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. Let me ask you a question. How well do you think you know people? And how well do you think they know you? 6 award-winning, best-selling authors of suspense explore the lingering threat of secrets and the inescapable fear that they can't stay buried forever. So no matter how dark the hiding place, the consequences of revealing the truth can bring out the worst in lovers, friends, family, and strangers. And check this out. You can read and listen to all 6 short stories in the Never Tell collection free with Prime. You can learn more at amazon.com/nevertell. And these best-selling authors include Liv Constantine, Laureth Ann White, Andrea Bartz, Rachel Halsell Hall, Avi Pachota, and Carolyn Kepnes. Again, you can read and listen to all 6 short stories free with Prime and also Kindle Unlimited. So make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman. The pressure cooker of minor league baseball leads to major chemistry in this exhilarating, sexy, and triumphant rivals to lovers debut romance. Gene Ionescu is the first openly trans player in professional baseball. He has nearly everything he's ever let himself dream of. That is, until Luis Estrada, Gene's former teammate and current rival, gets traded to the Beavers. Now, Gene and Luis can't manage a civil conversation off the field or a competent play on it, but in the close confines of dugout benches and roadie buses, they begrudgingly rediscover a comfortable rhythm. As the two grow closer, the tension between them turns electric, and their chemistry spills past the confines of the stadium. So this is one of the first adult rom-coms published by a major publishing house centering a gay trans man by a gay trans man. It also has ADHD and anxiety representation and some joyful, heartfelt moments. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman, for sponsoring this episode.
The National Book Awards has, I don't think followed suit is exactly right, but it's not exactly wrong. The National Book Awards, really since Lisa Lucas was in charge of it several years ago, yes, has been doing things to broaden the parameters for who is eligible. I guess technically it's the books that are judged, but the people that are eligible. That's a kind of a weird distinction. I never really put it in that way before. Oh, look at this giant James Patterson ad on the New York Times. Sorry, that's talking. we can talk about that in a second. And I guess the quickest way to summarize this is if your body resides primarily in the United States, you can win a National Book Award. Is that it? I mean, yes. I'm not sure what else to say about that.
Yeah, they've just expanded it beyond citizenship is no longer required. You just need to mostly live here. And this follows the Pulitzer's announcing last year that beginning with the 2025 prizes, permanent and longtime residents of the United States would be eligible for the awards. So, yeah, I was kind of having the same thoughts about is it following? I don't know that it's following suit. Following suit kind of has a negative to neutral connotation. Yeah. And the thing here is this is great. They're getting on board with progress that's being made. This piece also notes that the Academy of American Poets and the Poetry Foundation have expanded their prizes to include poetry by immigrants who have temporary legal status in the U.S. This is a thing that we're doing. We are thinking more, yes, expansively about what it means to be a work of American literature and to be a writer of American literature. And so our award-giving bodies are expanding those definitions as well.
The Academy of the American Poets and the Poetry Foundation are also expanding their prize to have, mm-hmm, similar parameters. I guess, yeah, following suit, I was struggling to find a better term. I think all of them are operating under the same penumbra of shame about having not done this before.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Responding to social pressure, certainly.
I think it's social pressure, but I also think these, again, you and I have this working theory that people that work these kinds of jobs or middle management jobs in publishing have basically the same, to a first approximation, cultural and political initiative, ideas, ambitions, and thoughts, yes, that we do, right? And usually,
yeah, the industry leans liberal.
Leans liberal. And you and I, are we more liberal than a marketing manager at Harper Via? I don't think so, actually, anymore. As I've gotten older, yeah, and they've gotten younger specifically. But legacy stuff, bureaucracy, no one's minding the store. There's a lots of reasons that an organization hasn't done something yet they would like to do that things are right, mm-hmm, and they do it now. And I don't think it has to be pressure necessarily than, oh, wait, we're in charge. Ain't no one's going to come, right, and say you can't open it up, Pulitzer Prizes or the National,
yeah,
Book
the
Foundation.
Pressure can come from inside the
go.
House.
That's
and
right.
I think it does. In a lot of these cases. It is folks who, you know, just as you were saying, share similar values to what we're doing at Book Riot and are looking for, like, you're working for the National Book Foundation, yeah, because you care about the place of literature in American society. And you're thinking about what that can mean in a way that's, you know, part of the National Book Awards mission is to expand awareness and access to literature, to get more people reading. And so thinking about acknowledging a broader conception of American writers is part of that. These are big organizations. They have young donors. They have old donors. Mm-hmm. They have rich people to contend with. They have PR concerns, both real and imagined. It's bureaucracy. And the larger the organization, the longer it takes typically to make a significant, that's right, change in any kind of direction. So I think you're right that they are responding to shame, probably some of it coming from inside the house about why have we not gotten to this place sooner, but they are finally able to make these changes. And at this point, just glad to see it happen. I have a lot of, you know, we've talked before about, you know, sympathy for the machine.
Yes.
And it's not so much, it's not letting anybody off the hook, but these are big organizations that have a lot of stakeholders who have a lot of different priorities, and to try to make everybody happy and make progress happen and not lose your funding,
yep,
that's not an easy needle to thread.
It's never too late to do the right thing. Never too soon either,
exactly.
I should say, right, here at the same time. Also, mm-hmm, weirdly bringing just their own rules and eligibility alignment, because apparently the journalism awards were open to non-citizens if their work was published by a U.S. media company.
Oh, interesting.
So that's pretty,
okay,
strange, too. I would imagine most, if not all, of the books considered for the National Book Awards going back in time were published by American publishers. So there was some, I guess, non-equal treatment. I don't know why. Again, that could just be legacy stuff. That someone didn't think to write it into the Journalism Award by rules back in 1911 or something like that. That's very possible. Mm-hmm. It wasn't. It was accidental inclusion rather than
intentional
ones. Yeah. So there's that. Is that going to change the winners? Maybe. Well, there'll be different kinds of people on there. I think Javier Zamora, we talked about his memoir, yes. Solito. When I first read that, I didn't even consider, didn't even think to think about eligibility for prizes, because I had the thought that it would be up for end of the year awards, and there's different kinds at different, but wasn't eligible for paperwork reasons.
Right.
And if art exists to do anything, it is to transcend paperwork, I would say.
Right.
And so thankfully,
truly,
that's happening now.
Yeah, it may not change the awards, but it could. And it's that possibility that's important, I think.
Yeah. Speaking of people that have changed the world of books, LeVar Burton has ascended to a secular saint of reading in the United States. I don't know what kind of profile he has in Canada or beyond in the Anglophone or non-Anglophone world for that matter. But certainly if you were to drop a list of 10 living reading icons. Again, the reading icon is a weird thing to say because there's lots of writers that are readers, of course. LeVar Burton is not known primarily as a writer. I'm not even sure he's known primarily as a book lover now because he's had an act. I mean, he's Kunta Kinte and Jordi LaForge, for God's sake. But, you know, he doesn't act all that much anymore and has turned his attention because of Reading Rainbow, which, if you're a longtime listener of your show, no, that relationship has been fraught. I wonder where LeVar and the double R stand right now. What kind of detente they are in right now.
And what kind of tea is he willing to spill about it?
Not much. Not when you have two giant book deals coming out. You are playing it close to the vest because you want to get picked up. You want NPR, Minnesota, whoever controls it, the rights to Reading Rainbow, to not be an antagonist to you. Signed a two-book deal with Pantheon. Speaking of Lisa Lucas, two shouts for L Squared today, who's the publisher, executive editor, I don't know what her title is, of Pantheon Books over at Random House. The first book coming in 2026, a memoir on how to be your authentic self. Okay. Yeah, this is my least exciting phrase in book. I don't care who it is. what if your authentic self is a dillweed? That's my always question about this. The second book on the importance of reading will follow in 2028. Now we're talking. I don't know why one before the other. We're many years away. I would imagine this is going to be a medium-ish to large deal, Rebecca. You've met LeVar Burton in the flesh. You have a selfie with him.
So I did.
You basically are a resident Burton expert.
The side of my face touched the side of his face.
Yeah.
I guess it's not surprising to me that one of these and the first of them is an inspirational how-to memoir. That is kind of the lane LeVar Burton occupies. It's also a low-friction lane for a celebrity who historically has at least avoided controversy and friction. Like, he got salty when he was hosting the National Book Awards year, making some jokes about Moms for Liberty, and that was especially satisfying, not just because Moms for Liberty deserves all of the saltiness that anybody can muster, but because LeVar Burton, like, he's had good media training and he remembers what they told him. Like, this is a very well-managed image. And so, like, how to be your authentic self, sort of like Michelle Obama style workbook memoir, is a thing that makes sense to me for him. What I would like is a no holds barred LeVar Burton, like After Dark, really tell the stories. I hope that he will go to that place. He's 67. You know, if you're going to let yourself, you know, off the hook and have a little free reign to really tell those stories, he's experienced quite a lot. And being a very famous, very recognizable Black man in this country in several decades where that was even more difficult than it is right now.
What do you think the cultural conversation around Roots was when he was... I mean, can you imagine now what he had to go through and what people were saying?
The internet didn't exist. Man. Can you, like,
That's a good...
I cannot imagine.
That would be an amazing, like... Someone should do a alternate history where some for some reason there was Twitter in 1968.
Now we get discourse on things.
Like, that, you know, what would have been like? Hippies are out there blasting tweets. What would that look like? I have no idea. Anyway, how would history have changed?
Yeah.
But you can only imagine that the racial politics today are, I think it's fair to say, evolved since then. Long ways to go, so on and so forth. But he had that experience of playing a... this. Hard to remember now. It was a broadcast, multi-part, made-for-TV adaptation of Roots with, like, probably... I would have to imagine at the time there had been no broader, more realistic depiction of slavery in the American public than before Roots. It has to be the case. What would it have been?
It's pretty shocking that that got made.
It really is shocking.
From where we're sitting... right now.
An oral history of Roots is definitely something I would read on Vulture. So get on that.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
So I think this will be interesting. I think the for the book world one, the reading focus book could be interesting. But on the importance of reading, that could be the most anodyne twill. You know, I don't know what that could be. I don't know. It's going to be exciting. It's hard to do that with any kind of say something that hasn't been said a million times.
Right. Especially with the proliferation of, like, the New York Times has the by the book column. Yeah. I think it's Vanity Fair has something similar. The Guardian has a version of this where authors talk about the books that shaped them. We've done podcasts around it. Like, this is a familiar kind of content because it's fun and interesting. And people like to know what their favorite writers and celebrities are reading. But, like, to get a whole book's worth of material out of it, I do think you have to go some places, because the things that books... the role that books play in our lives and the ways that they can change us are really personal, can be challenging, and that hits you at the deepest place. It's like you have to kind of go to vulnerable is not wanting to come out of my mouth today. You have to go to that place to talk about what books have meant to you if it's going to do something other than be, you know, like a yay, books, reading is nice kind of thing. And that's, I think, what I and maybe the reading public have been wanting from LeVar Burton, is like, you are very important and very recognizable, and he has played a lot of significant roles both on screen and just in the world of activism around reading. Like, you can really have some teeth now. And some of the things that he said in the announcements of these books make me inclined to, I don't know, think or hope that he's ready to go there. He says, you know, this is my opportunity to go on record, to weigh in. I have earned the respect of this nation, and I've earned the right to speak my piece, not simply because of what I've done, but simply because I am here. He's got weight and he's got heft, and he has earned the right to, you know, take up this space and have our attention and say whatever it is that he has to say. And so I really hope that he will do it. I want this to be something more than a pat, like, yay for books, reading is important message.
Yeah, should be interesting to see. But we're certainly getting at the LeVar Burton tour. Speaking of tours, I'm tipping my frontless foyer.
Look at you.
I'm going back and forth in time. I'm going to wrest Twitter away from the hippies and come back to the present moment for a second. Leslie Jameson's publicist is murdering it, by the way. There have been so many pieces, everything, every place that could have a Leslie Jameson profile, interview, excerpt, essay has done it. And I don't think when we talked about it, I'm sure we came up in multiple of our previews, I don't think we talked about as, is Leslie Jameson going to break out? I don't think I was thinking in those terms.
I wasn't either.
But I feel like maybe it could happen. Have you started? Have you read it? Have you started? Where are you?
Oh, I read it. Yeah, I talked about it on Frontlist Foyer.
That's right.
It's great.
I'm a little into it. It is great. So I'm wondering.
Past Jeff and Rebecca, I think maybe should have had an inkling that this might break her out, because the things she's written about before have been both niche and kind of heady. And nothing is more grounded and relatable than people have messy relationships. And here's the story of mine.
Yeah.
And nobody is better at human mess than Leslie Jameson is. I would love for this to be her breakout. Also, notably, Liz Lenz's divorce memoir / manifesto, which is called This American Ex-Wife, came out on the same day earlier this week as Leslie Jameson.
You hate to see it if you're them.
Except they don't seem to be, like, canceling each other out. They seem to be this one seems to be additive in the media that I've seen. It's like, if you need to read one divorce book, maybe you need to read two. Here you go.
You know,
so good for them.
I don't know what the canon of divorce memoirs is. I've read a bunch of them recently, and some of them got mixed up with COVID and baby ring stuff, and I don't know how.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem like Splinter's is very COVID forward, which thankfully is good, because that part of my reading tongue is numb at this point. But interesting to see, and I wonder, because for a while the food memoir was undersaturated. It's not the word. Mm-hmm. But then it got oversaturated. We'd even talked about, I need a hook on a food memoir now. You can't be like a chef and like, here's my life as a cook. Like, I need something else besides to get interested about that. And I wonder how much longer I feel like you have to do something different now with the divorce book. Is Leslie Jamison's writing a divorce memoir? You know, I don't know that if Glennon Doyle doesn't do Love Warrior 6 years ago, there's a lot of like, this is an exciting book anymore.
And it's interesting, like the Glennon Doyle of it all is kind of how these things start.
Yes.
Like the Glennon Doyle version of a divorce memoir is the inspirational, I survived this, so can you.
No reservations. Reservations of divorce memoirs.
Right. Yeah. And then Leslie Jamison is a sharper and deeply personal, kind of warts and all. Here's the gross stuff. And Liz Lenz's spin on it is kind of memoir, but more structural criticism of the institution of marriage. Like she talks about her marriage, she talks about her ex, but she situates all of it inside, let's look at the history of marriage, heterosexual marriage, especially in America, what this has meant for gender politics, what it has meant for the oppression of women, the ways that even a good marriage today can continue to be a source of oppression for women, and like why should straight people, especially straight women, continue to get married when we have all of these, you know, other options that are available to us. And she's really arguing for that heterosexual marriage is a source of misery for many people who enter into the institution, and that even a miserable marriage benefits the man in it in a way that it does not benefit the woman. And is specifically taking on hetero marriage, addresses some of the other things. But that feels like a progression to me. If you get like the inspirational Glennon Doyle version, you get the Leslie Jamison, like literary, philosophical, thoughtful take. And then now we also have these sort of structural critiques of the institution itself.
A future idea for a Patreon episode for us is name the 7 authors you would least like to hear is writing a book about the topic you are currently writing about. And I would put Leslie Jamison up there.
That you have to do for some, any of them.
I don't care what the topic is. I think I put Isabel Wilkerson up there.
Michael Lewis.
Mukherjee, for some reason, wanted to write about, I don't know, the history of the world in 17 books. I don't even know what book I'm theoretically writing. I don't want Mukherjee anywhere close to what I'm doing at this particular point. But Jemison's up there. Anyway, that's a preview of my front list for you. And I'm doing that in Book and Love now. I'm not through with either.
Yeah, I'm just in early days of Book of Love too. I'm really curious what Leslie Jamison will do next.
That was my next question could be for you.
Yeah, like this could be the breakout. And then to stay broken out, she would need to stay in more mainstream subjects of concern. She could still do it the Leslie Jamison way.
She'd have to Brene Brown it to some way. She's going to speak on stages with a head mic about finding your true self crap. She's not going to do that, is she? I don't think she is.
I don't think I need her to break out to Brene Brown, Glennon Doyle levels of broken out. Let's let her sell some more books. You know, and like not be quite as niche. You know, the empathy exams is so wonderful, and the her memoir about getting sober, also really wonderful.
Yes.
But this is, you know, highly relatable, and it's just like, well, once you've gone highly relatable, you either go much nichier, like you go back into the cave, make your money from your highly relatable story, and now you can underwrite getting weird again. And man, I like Leslie Jamison in weird mode, so I wouldn't hate that.
I agree.
I would prefer for her to just like make a lot of money on this and then go back into weirdness. Personally.
Yeah, I have some sense of her from reading her books and reading the press, and she seems like a pretty odd person. In a good way. And maybe not as tempted by the filthy lucre of the speaking engagement tour.
Yeah. From what she reveals about her life in Splinters, I don't know that there are like a lot of other angles of it that she could make into something that's a super mainstream accessible spin. And that's great. Continue getting interested in weird stuff. And, please go down those rabbit
holes. And the people
that
did this, like, you know, the went from a book that broke out, that resonated with people, to become a notional guru of some kind or lifestyle, whatever. They don't write sentences. None of them write sentences like Leslie Jamison, or care as much about writing sentences like Leslie Jamison.
I don't think there's much Leslie Jamison wants less than to be a guru of anything.
Now, if she tried to and it fell apart and then wrote a memoir about that, I would read that memoir.
That's like the inverse of that "Sure, I'll join your cult" memoir that was out last year.
Right.
Yeah, I would read that. She likes to follow, you know, interesting ideas and sort of outsidery stuff, and I like following her there. So I want to see that continue.
I'm not sure where we were. We were talking about LeVar Burton and Breaking Out, right? Breaking Out in publicity campaigns.
Oh, yes.
That's what got me here.
Yeah.
Somewhat strangely, but there we are anyway.
But here we are, yeah. My last, I think, Leslie Jamison thought is, like, there's almost no more mainstream experience than becoming a parent and getting a divorce. Like, I've got a friend who, when somebody is, you know, freaking out to announce that they're pregnant, she'll be privately like, congratulations, you're doing the same thing everyone else has done all of history. Right. And so it's hard to make a memoir about that, those experiences that are so common, interesting and fresh and new, and that's really what she's done here.
Let's take a much dreaded and frequent return visit to book banning hellscape lane. It's a cul-de-sac we cannot seem to get out of at this point. This is West Virginia. The House of Delegates has passed legislation lifting criminal liability exemptions from schools and the presentation of local or state-approved curriculum in public libraries and museums displaying obscene matter to a minor when the child is not accompanied by a parent or guardian. This, we are now approaching the reducto ad absurdum that you and I said, well, the slippery slope argument is something like this. And you know what? It turned out the slope was greased and oiled, and people were ready at the top of it to push this stuff down. The bill will go to the Senate, and I am, as you know, not an expert in the civic governance of the state of West Virginia. Probably there's a governorship thing that must happen as well. Basically, if something obscene matter, which usefully is extremely easy to identify, define, and isn't all prone to manipulation or abuse by those who seek to do ill, means if you display it to a minor, you could be charged with a felony up to $25,000. In 5 years in the clink, which seems reasonable to me, Rebecca. This seems fine. I don't know why we're not doing this already.
Oh,
so nothing else to say.
Yeah. Yeah, just these very usefully vague definitions of obscenity that rely on things a reasonable person would determine to be obscene. And I mean, given that nothing else about this sounds reasonable, I don't have a whole lot of faith in the judgments that might be made there. I'm not, like you, super familiar with West Virginia's state politics. West Virginia does have a Republican governor. Hard to imagine that he's going to come out swinging against this. We'll see what happens in the West Virginia State Senate. Really interesting to track this trend that we've been talking about, where you have some states doubling down and getting ready to send librarians to prison at the same time that other states are actively putting measures in place to prevent book bans from happening at all. Not surprising, given how polarized the red state, blue state conversation has become, and just increasingly polarized over the last 8 years, but this book banning conversation over the last two or three. I continue to think this is a losing issue. It's just how long will they be able to to skate by on passing some of these things before the big losses kick in?
It says Brandon Steele, the introducer of this bill, says what this does is tear down the sanctuary for conduct that all of us have agreed for over 100 years is criminal. If it is illegal in the parking lot, it should be illegal in the building. So I don't know what the hell we're talking about here. Can give no examples of specific cases under which someone be prosecuted by this. I don't think this is actually about getting anyone anywhere or anyone to pay a fine. This is just to scare the shit out of librarians so they don't put stuff by queer people on the shelves. That's what this is. That's all this is.
Yeah. It's to continue trying to equate any representation of queer identity or discussion of sexual identity with pornography, to continue to present librarians and educators as groomers and sexual abusers, and notably Brandon Steele. And if that's not a supervillain name, yeah, Jeff, I don't know what is, has provided no, zero, big old goose egg examples of someone committing similar acts in state libraries. Yeah. So this is like a straw man to the nth degree.
Delegate Mike Pushkin, a Democrat, offered an unsuccessful amendment Friday that would have kept in place criminal liability protections for teachers, citing examples of, say, health teachers who provide instruction in sex education. The amendment failed by one voice, by voice vote. I'm not so sure who the arbiter of what is obscene and what isn't, Pushkin said. That makes sure we're not going to penalize teachers simply for teach. But here's the thing, Mike Pushkin. They don't want people to teach sex education.
Exactly.
They're not like, oh, you're right,
they
Mike.
They don't want that.
What if we show someone what a cervix is? We can't throw them in jail, can we? No, they do not want you to know where all the parts are or where they go or the any manners of which you could put them to use for the pleasure of yourself or others. Sucks. Hate it. The worst. May your efforts fail.
May your efforts fail.
ALA releases book resumes to help fight book bans. I think we saw someone talking about this before. I linked to a tweet in Today in Books last week that every library did the math on what it would take to actually have humans review the context of all the books published in a year to give them ratings. Let me just say we're sort of in an infinite timeline with infinite monkeys on infinite typewriters situation.
It's absurd.
It's absurd. This is the ALA is trying to give – I think this is understandable, wrongheaded, and doomed to fail at the same time, all these things. Much like what was we were talking about. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The idea is like, can we give some kind of seal of content so that librarians and teachers don't have to do all the work themselves, and that, you know, we can give a parent or a teacher or a librarian basically an abstract or a one sheet or an executive summary that summarized the significance, the value, reviews, basically saying this deserves to be here, I guess. It's basically a stamp saying this deserves to be here, no matter what you might think of that one scene on page 71 in which someone kisses somebody that isn't their same gender, or maybe even kisses anybody at all. I wouldn't be so surprised if they're trying to get all this crap. This is not gonna work. I mean, again, I see what people are trying to do, but here's the thing: like before, anyone who's interested in getting books out of libraries that they think are gonna pollute little Jimmy with 21st century ideas about anything is not gonna be like, oh, I see you know what? Thank you for that book resume. I see that it got reviewed in the New York Times. It was long listed for the Caldecott. I'm good. Let it go. They're not gonna do that, Rebecca. So what are we doing here?
Yeah, I can see ways like these resumes do also include information about how a title has been successfully retained in school districts.
Okay.
So maybe if we're getting into like, here's a way to like sort of in a positively nitpicky fashion, like get this book through to find some loopholes. I can see how that might be strategically useful. But the rest of this does turn on a logic that doesn't exist,
yes,
or really on the assumption that you're dealing with logical actors. And most, if not all, of these attempts to ban books are not built on any kind of logic or any kind of reason. They're built on, we don't want this thing, and that's all I need to know about it is that I don't like it.
That's
and
right.
So it should not be there.
There's something. Let's
if they were interested, exactly, if they were interested, if folks trying to ban books were interested in any kind of civil discourse, in any kind of argument, in having to assess evidence, they would, I don't know, actually read the books that they're objecting to instead of taking hearsay. We would make it a lot harder to, like, school districts would uniformly make it a lot harder to ban these things. There wouldn't be like a one-page worksheet with a two-line slot for why do you object to this, where someone can just say, I heard it has gay people in it, and that's sufficient to at least get it taken off the shelves while someone evaluates it. Like, this functions inside, like, this is a tool to function inside this system that exists, and the real solutions, as we've been saying, are going to come from outside of this system. They're going to come from legislative and legal action that you know, either makes it against the law to ban books from your schools, for school boards to do it, for individuals to do it, whatever, or that are providing greater protections coming out from the First Amendment for students and teachers.
Yep. Let's move on to happier things. I don't know that we're going to talk about in detail. I'm glad you put it here. I have been saving this Marilynne Robinson interview in the Times, much like I have not touched my digital galley of reading Genesis, which I think comes out on the 12th, something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's great. I don't know what to say. I think she...
It is great.
As a writer who tends to do... She... There's one sentence where it talks about the state of the U.S. In particular. And the word she uses, which I would not have used to think of characterizing, and I think it's indicative. It's not wholly encompassing, but it's indicative of a piece of it that I think it's hard to articulate. It's a stinginess. Stinginess. Which is usually used in regards to, you know, financial matters, of being miserly, but a miserliness in fellow feeling, of tolerance, of welcoming of a kind.
Yeah.
And from that central stinginess, many things have emanated. And I think that resonated with me. And that was just in the first few graphs here. And I don't know what else to say about the rest.
She's a gift. Marilynne Robinson is a gift. This is a wonderful profile. That line about stinginess and something else that she says about being disillusioned by the vulgarity and the mercilessness that have entered public conversation. She says meagerness and unwillingness to be a source of benefit to the people in the country at large. All of that feels true in a way that I hadn't articulated with those words either, and feels very, it makes a lot of sense coming from Marilynne Robinson, whose work is populated with a real spirit of generosity and expansiveness about humanity and the centrality of human connections to our happiness, our health, the functioning of our societies, both large and small. Just glad to see. Like Marilynne Robinson, she's 80 years old. Mm. She has a lot of wisdom. She's been thinking about things for a long time. And we need wise elders to weigh in. More of this, more of the time, please. Plus the fun little anecdote where David Marchese, or Marchese, I'm not sure Marchese, how he pronounces it. The interviewer is like trying to get Marilynne Robinson to admit to like what naughty thing does she do, and he's like, come on, give me something. Do you even just like steal ketchup packets? Right. And she's nope. Like her bad is that she's bad at returning letters, and she has even fallen off of being President Obama's pen pal. Like they're not pen paling anymore, and it's her fault. But she will not steal a ketchup packet. I just love this. Flex. Right. She seems to regret it, as I think is probably appropriate. But just a lovely piece. I would really love for Marilynne Robinson. Like, if she had a podcast, could I just listen to this on Sunday mornings? I don't want to go to church the way Marilynne Robinson goes to church, but I would like to go to the church of Marilynne Robinson. It's talking about people who could start a cult.
It is helpful to have, from time to time, a missive from the semi-reclusive thinkers of the world that are not engaging with the week by week, minute by minute, quarter by quarter, cycle by cycle hour. Because she's not disinterested or unaware of whatever you want to call them, current events, politics, or whatever.
Right.
But she is looking at them from a different perspective. That
is
incisive and synthetic and at an engaging remove that has a certain clarity.
Engaging remove is a good word.
A clarity that's useful. And she is not there. She's not interested in being particularly clever. She's not there in cleverness. I'm not, she's smarter than I will ever be. I'm not saying it's not, she's not there for a joke, to make a joke, to make
there's no irony.
Points, to manage her brand. I presume she has had no media training at all. And nor does she need it, because she doesn't care to say the kinds of things that people would get into trouble for saying at the same time. So I'm glad to see her again, as I always am to see. Would it kill me to have a new novel? No. Am I grateful I'm reading Genesis? Absolutely.
I think we have decided to go back and redo housekeeping together.
Is that what we decided to do? Okay. All right. Did we do a second sponsor break? I think we did not. Let me get one in here.
Okay.
Today's episode is brought to you by Unchipped, the most epic dystopian science fiction adventure series that you've probably never heard of. And bonus points because it's Finnish. And when's the last time you read a Finnish dystopian science fiction novel? Right. Okay. So in this one, humanity is destroying itself as the cities burn, which sounds kind of familiar. It is the time of the great affliction. In this terrible world, a new hope arises. The Happiness Program, which is the creation of a Finnish pharmaceutical genius, Dr. Laura Solomon. With happiness, pills, mind mapping, and microchips, Dr. Solomon intends to build a new world for the worthy few, which sounds like a perfect plan and nothing could go wrong, right? Right. So this is a raw but fun dystopian sci-fi adventure with an unusual premise describing what happens when technology rules humanity. Either you're chipped living inside the AR society or you're left outside to barely survive. Make sure to check out Unchipped by Taya DeVere. And thanks again to Unchipped, the most epic dystopian science fiction adventure series that you've probably never heard of, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Taming Seven is an epic and unforgettable love story in the international best-selling and TikTok phenomenon The Boys of Tommen series from Chloe Walsh. So Tommen's cheekiest lad, Jared Gibbsy Gibson, has always been a comedian, but inside he is haunted by events of the past and he uses humor to cope, hiding his true self from the world. Then you have Claire Biggs, who is the epitome of sunshine. She's always loved Gibbsy, her brother's friend and her favorite neighbor. She also has always seen a side to him that no one else seems to notice, and she becomes determined to tame her wild at heart childhood best friend. So the Boys of Tommen series is an internationally best-selling YA romance series that has taken TikTok by storm. It's perfect for readers looking for new adult slash crossover romance, dual point of views, friends to lovers, marathon-worthy TikTok books, and angsty tearjerkers. Taming Seven is published today, and it's the fifth book in the series, so make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode.
I'm going to blow past, we stepped on Front List Foyer. I'm going to enter into the record this story about KKR talking about its plans for Simon & Schuster. This is in Publishers Weekly last week. I linked to it there. I wanted to have a chance to talk for a minute on the podcast. I thought a couple things were interesting. One, it's Jim Milliot, who's retiring after 30 years at Publishers Weekly. We probably cited his byline as much. It's Alexander Alter and Jim Milliot, probably. Those are the two that we've shouted out the most doing the...
Constance Grady.
Yeah, Constance Grady. Yeah. Yeah, I would bring her into the fold as well. Cal Reed, who's now retired as well at Publishers Weekly. So he's aggregating with some context an interview on Bloomberg that Pete Stavros, who's the co-head of Global Equity KKR, said, they're in no hurry to sell Simon & Schuster. Couple things. Selling a company is that it takes as long as it takes. 5 to 7 years before it looks to own a home. So for those of you who don't know, what P&E generally does is take an asset they think is undervalued, either because it's not being run well, or sometimes if it's a subsidiary, I think in this case, of a larger company where its full value is not being recognized because it's drowned out by everything else that's going on. They take it, they polish it up, they shine it up, they replace parts, and usually means cutting some staff. It just does, usually. Mm-hmm. Not always, but usually. And then get ready to sell to someone else who is in the market for a refurbished Porsche. They didn't want to refurbish the Porsche themselves, but they're interested in having a refurbished Porsche. And that's what they do. So, and that they thought this was a neglected gem. We talked about this before, that looking at the numbers, S&S was profitable. They were making money, for sure. It's been one of the most profitable large publishers of late. And there's other ways they can do. So I think they're going to sell this thing in 5 to 7 years, and we're going to be right back to square one about what to do with S&S and conglomeration and who's going to buy it. We're going to be right back to, I guess it's going to depend who's in the White House and you know what else, the DOJ or the FTC or the FCC. I'm not even sure who covers these things anymore. See my earlier discourse on the West Virginia State Legislature for my canniness with political comings and goings. But we're going to be right back here, and the world will not have changed. Yep. Nothing will have changed about S&S. So I put it unto you, Is this something we are excited to see? Are we gonna? Is the world going to be any different? Or are we going to be right back to where we were with PRH? Is like, well, I can't buy that. The last time it cost us a couple billion dollars, so I can't imagine getting wading back into that pool. So that leaves you within a bunch of other publishers where like Macmillan is going to absorb. They're going to try to buy them, or HarperCollins, like, or they're going to be sold. They're going to be have an IPO, and they're going to be a publicly traded publishing house, which I think is a bad idea, frankly, because of the way growth and profitability and. I just don't know what else there is. Maybe some other holding company. Maybe they do sell it to someone's like, I don't really like to refurbish stuff, but if you give me a profitable company that's turning out a 7% margin every year, I will give you a fair price for it that's more than you paid for it, and now it's part of this other kind of thing. So I don't even know what publishing. The kinds of people who have big opinions about what companies should do with themselves, I don't think people understand generally there's not a lot of good answer here. There's no magic answer that's going to make SNS independent and owned by itself just because you want it to be that way.
Right. And somehow magically free of all of the trappings of corporate capitalism.
Yeah, or macroeconomic trends or the market they're in or whatever.
Right. Yeah, I don't think that this is terribly exciting now. It was interesting what was going on with PRH and Simon & Schuster. How the court was going to decide that was an interesting question to follow. But I don't think anyone is excited about a future sale other than KKR, which will make the money, and whoever merges or buys Simon & Schuster and the money that they stand to make from it. Everybody else will be on some scale of like, to really upset. I think authors are just going to continue to be rightfully concerned that consolidation means fewer opportunities for them. Folks who want to work in publishing will continue to be concerned that consolidation will mean fewer opportunities for them to work in publishing. None of those things are right or wrong. Companies do what they do, and nobody has an unassailable right to work in the industry that they want to work in. It's not the industry doing something wrong to you or a corporation doing something wrong to you when they merge with someone else and then a future possible opportunity is no longer future possible. This feels like this is just going to be the conversation that we're going to have for a while of like publishing is trying to consolidate. Publishing is continuing to try to consolidate, but we're out of big players. They can't merge with the biggest one. Which kind of means that none of the rest of the stories are all that interesting. So Simon & Schuster goes and merges with some smaller publisher. Okay.
And let me tell you another thing. KKR is not going to be happy with, we got 15% more for SNS than we paid for it. It's going to be expensive to buy. It's going to be, I mean, multiple billion dollars times multiple billion dollars is still multiple billions of dollars. There's not a lot of people in publishing that can absorb that. And interest rates are high now. I guess that might be a different kind of a situation. Maybe in 5 to 7 years, you know, interest rates are lower, so it's easier for someone to take on the debt. But I just don't see it. I really don't understand what's going to happen.
Yeah, I think the thing I'm most interested in about this will be what does KKR do with sort of the boots on the ground functioning of Simon & Schuster as they make it more profitable? Does some of that money get returned to employees in the form of higher pay? Do they invest in more diverse pipelines of both material and staffing? Are they using some of that money to kind of try to do the things that we want books to do in the world? Or will it tilt more towards the stereotypical understanding of private equity that we're just generating more profit for the sake of more profit? All of those things are possible. The second one is definitely the rule, the like read on it that the internet discourse had around like, oh my God, these private equity guys, look what they're going to do. I don't think they have any intention to like to gut Simon & Schuster or to ruin publishing. They've been very clear about that. But like the point of private equity, as you were saying in the top of the show, unless you're Warren Buffett, is acquire it, build it, make it more valuable, sell it, make your money.
Yeah, they're house flippers.
And that's what they're going to do.
They have this ownership plan where you get a stake in the company, and if it sells eventually for more, then you get the, you know, there's a lot of ways this can be structured. So some of that would be returned to employees that probably vest or whatever. It's a way of motivating them. So it's worth more, not that you're just like working hard so that someone else can make even more money than they already made. That's a pretty hard thing, I would imagine, to work at. It's, you know, say they're going to try to do some science to predict which books are going to sell. That reminded me, How long have we been hearing about this? Have we heard one person say, you know what, we got this analytics platform and these packages, and it turns out we know how to do this? Have you heard any? I mean, I ask unto thee, listeners of the internet, can you show me the story where some publisher said, you know, we have all these analytics platforms and they've really paid off, and we learned that yellow covers of Women with Daisies on May 9th sell better and we're killing it? Because we hear about this, we use data and analytics to see and consumer insights. And as far as I can tell, there's a grand total of squat to show for it.
Yes. It's a very Wizard of Oz. The wizard is just a man standing behind a curtain feeling when publishers talk about this stuff, because I think part of it is there are so many possible data points about a book.
Right.
When did it come out? What else was coming out? What genre was it? What did the cover look like? You know, how long is it? Is the author famous? Did it get on TikTok? There's so many variables. And publishing is not keeping detailed data about the books they publish along those variables. Like, the closest that we can get are the like very filtered down, like, is it BISAC, like ISBN codes, where you're like,
maybe
this is memoir about food.
I heard some stuff that Random House maybe has a tool they use. I don't know what it entails. Maybe they're, but as far as I can tell, most of the time it's, hey, romanticy, or what about lady spies, or how about stuff about book clubs in World War II? I'm not kidding. Like, then you see a bunch of them, but I don't think you need, you know, Google Gemini AI Supreme Plus with NVIDIA chips in it.
Put girl in the title.
Just to see, like, you know what's selling now? Let's do more of that. Because have fun predicting. How about the thing that's not just dovetailing off something else? That'd be super interesting.
Right.
We learned there's a market for mushroom hunting, I don't know, backpackers who also play the banjo. And it'd be like, that'd be the one that I'd like to see. It's like something that's way out of scale, that's like didn't have get human level, like duh quality to it. Because everything I see is like me too stuff. Because I don't think lessons in chemistry, I mean, look at the things that sold. That was an editor saying, this is amazing, I'm going to help Bonnie Garmus write this. And it turned out they were right. Or tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. Or stuff gets picked up on BookTok. Have fun with that algorithm, because it changed. Anyway, I've had enough of
this. Me too. And even I've said it like several weeks in a row. I am so tired of the fact that all the romance novels look the same.
Yeah.
Like, there's just a point where this isn't helping you.
You don't need an algorithm with a bunch of like chips being water cooled by you know, ice lakes to figure out that this is what people are buying now.
And the books that sold the most in 2023 are books that came out in 2022 and 2021.
And so which means they were acquired in 2019 at the earliest.
If we are still acquiring books in 2024 based on what's been selling, then we're talking about acquisitions inspired by books that were acquired 5 years ago and that won't be published for two more years. And to assume that the thing that worked then will continue to be working 2 or 3 years in the future is a big assumption, and it doesn't typically pay off. And my favorite hobby horse example of this is we still have not gotten the next Gone Girl. We're not going to.
Yeah.
and these things are singular and special because they're singular and special.
And maybe there's niche stuff. Maybe we're looking too macro, and down micro there are, I don't know, chili crisp cookbooks. Remember that thing that was like on the Barnes & Noble thing? Maybe that was something that's like, you know what? We see there's a lot of talk online about chili crisp. Let's do a chili crisp cookbook. I guess that's possible. When it comes to the books that even sniff the mainstream of American life, and ain't many of them that are within a nose of that, they resist any attempts, as has always been the case, to prescribe, predict, or dictate their success.
The biggest like book moments, cultural book moments of our shared reading consciousness are The Da Vinci Code, 50 Shades of Grey,
Twilight.
Now you've got this romanticy stuff. And and all of those are things that, like, when they came out, people were like, listen to this. Yeah. Can you believe that this is the thing that is so big? Like, I remember Dan Brown on all the morning talk shows for like months when The Da Vinci Code came out. And it was the same story around 50 Shades of Grey. It's kind of been the same story around Colleen Hoover. We're starting to see the same thing around Sarah J. Maas. Those were not predictable. Nobody was like, you know, this is going to be huge.
Yeah, and I just, and I don't know, maybe there's things I don't understand about this, but I think the stuff like we want to have better editors so authors want to come to us, now that makes sense to me.
Yes.
We want to have better infrastructure to reduce returns, now that makes sense to me. The yada yada AI predictive big data stuff, we just haven't seen a company do that. We haven't seen someone come out that can do stuff like this.
Yeah, I think if you've got somebody being like, we can guarantee you that we're going to market your book into being a bestseller, that's a real moment to take a pause and ask them how. And if it's anything other than we're going to spend $1 jillion to make it unavoidable, and there's just a point at which a marketing campaign will be successful because you've put so much money into it, then I don't believe them. Like, there is not a formula for this. People are not doing this successfully with a formula. Yeah. And some of these examples that we're citing, like Colleen Hoover and 50 Shades of Grey, publishing did not recognize
twice.
The potential in those
twice
first.
They didn't recognize
right.
It.
Both of those authors self-published before mainstream publishing houses picked them up. So if publishing was like any good at guessing what the next big thing is going to be, we would have gotten on those.
And I'm not saying that they should be able to do it. What I'm saying is I don't think it's possible.
No.
I'm not saying they're doing it wrong. I think it's
exactly.
A thing that cannot
right.
be done.
I don't think it exists. Yeah. I agree.
Or the best thing to do is try to publish interesting things that you think people are going to like. Run your business sustainably so that you can wait a while and you're not just crossing your fingers and hoping to strike it rich just because, you know, do the infrastructure things. I mean, frankly, a lot of time these private equity people do a good job with these companies. It's because whoever was running it before them did not care or was an idiot or was corrupt. I'm not kidding about this. There are that happens all the time. And probably just by saying we care that SNS is a better company and able to stand on its own and be attractive to someone else, it will be run better. It will be. So I don't think you need to like say, dismissive of AI, but this, I don't know why that it's one line about a little more science. It feels like I always feel that little more science people, when it comes to cultural products, do not understand what makes culture culture. There's a butterfly effect thing here.
Yes.
That the culture is chaos theory. It is not big data. It just isn't.
Most of what happens in books and publishing is an art. And I think we should talk about that and we should celebrate it and we should explore what that looks like. And it does make this form of art and expression different from something like network television, where that's a little more predictable and it is more of the same. You know, like the Big Bang Theory was big for 15 years? And so let's give them Young Sheldon. And that was successful.
Well, I think publishing does that, though.
Work.
That's the James Pattersons of the world. I mean, not for nothing.
Well,
like, a lot of the money is made off that. But in terms of, but that's not science. That's like you got lucky with one and you made a brand out of it. Like, I don't understand what's science doesn't have anything to do with that. So anyway, it got me thinking again. So I think both on one side and the other, I'm like, KKR is not what you think. KKR is not, I do not believe, a big oil type company, a strip miner. I don't think it's like that. Could be, could be wrong. I also don't think they are, you know, some secret skunk work team at McKinsey that's got skeleton keys to figuring this out that other people don't
have. Yeah. And they don't seem interested or intent on like selling Simon & Schuster for parts.
No. So, I don't know how you would sell it for parts. I mean, when you break it right down, what is a publishing company? Their essential asset is the intellectual rights they have to books they've published and their ability to do more. There's not a lot of assets. It's like, how are you going to break off the rights to Stephen King?
Right.
I don't understand how that would happen.
Right.
It's wild.
I think the objections to KKR are primarily really objections to the idea and existence of private equity.
Or corporations at all, frankly.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, again,
and those are
fair to a degree, but, you know, these are the world we live in for now.
Right. Not operating in the realm of reality for this industry.
The proximally plausible to some degree. All right. I guess I got head up about that a little bit. That's our show, bookriot.com/listen. Do you want to check out the show notes and see what's there? You can check the Patreon, patreon.com/bookriotpodcast. Shoot us an email, podcast@bookriot.com. Got two new episodes of First Edition coming out next week. How about that? Interviews lined up. Rebecca, help me get some people. Well, should I say? So we're going to do one on e-readers.
Give us one teaser.
Yeah, one on e-readers. State of E-readers with Jason Snell, which I've had in the can for a couple weeks, but I've been sick and everything got in the way. But then I have some stuff around the 40th anniversary of House on Mango Street coming out.
Ooh,
you have some exciting authors with books coming out pretty soon. One, some you've heard of. Some that are, you know, people we've talked about on the show possibly. So do not worry. I will not be remiss in plugging those once they were alive. But thank you for the opportunity to say a little something about them. Great. Rebecca, I'm going to talk to you in 5 minutes about something else.
Deals, baby, deals.
Deals, baby.